A topic that indeed we've covered on this programme in the past, and the topic indeed I've been following over the last couple of years, is the undisclosed, a report recently brought it to mind again, that an undisclosed number of former rugby players are taking a case against the Irish Rugby Football Union in relation to serious brain injuries sustained during their playing careers. The Irish Times reported that proceedings are expected to be issued before October, with the case being taken by Dublin-based solicitors Maguire, McLaffey, and who specialise in litigation and personal injury law. Now, we're not going into the details of legal cases today, but the claimants in regard, there's a number of legal cases, not just in Ireland, but also the Welsh Rugby Union was in the headlines recently when former Wales captain Ryan Jones and England's 2003 World Cup winning hooker Steve Thompson argued that the sports governing bodies are negligent in that they failed to take reasonable action to protect players from permanent injury caused by repetitive concussive and sub-concussive blows. As I told you, Jones is only 41 years of age, played for the British and Irish Lions squad on the 2005 tour of New Zealand. He revealed his diagnosis with early onset dementia and possible CTE in an interview with the Sunday Times earlier this month. I think that interview was by David Walsh. I recall reading it myself. Well, let's talk about more in detail about the issue then. Professor Bill Tormey is one of our foremost consultants in the country. He's consultant at Beaumont Hospital and a specialist in what's called chemical pathology. Good morning, Professor Tormey.
Hello, Clem.
Thank you indeed for joining us this morning. Now, this area of concussion and CTE. Let's begin maybe by explaining what those two terms mean.
Concussion really means the effect, the fuzzy effect of getting a bang on the head, basically, and it has known for a hell of a long time. It was first described about 1910 or thereabouts in boxing, where people were diagnosed after a while as being punch drunk. And what that meant was that they got hit in the head so often that they had deteriorated mentally and has progressed along nicely along until suddenly in American football over 10 years ago, people noticed from post-mortem studies that there was a hell of a lot of deterioration in people in American football players, professional American football players, who got banged on the head. And it's much worse. What happens is that if you get knocked out once, it's easier to knock you out again and again and again, and gets progressively easier. And one of the reasons is that the cells in your brain become damaged, and the metabolism, that's the workings of the brain cells, become messed up, so that the proteins that are in the brain start to join together and form neurofibrillary tangles and all this kind of stuff. And really what happens is that the brain cells become dysfunctional, and over a while this shows itself up by behavioural changes in the persons that this occurs in. The sorts of things that happen at a younger age, around 35, people become impulsive, aggressive. They have violent tendencies and they have a personality change, and it progresses to difficulty in cognition, where some of the people that have been reported in the press that you've actually mentioned already begin to fail to recognise their own families. And this is extremely worrying.
And this is the early onset dementia that you're talking about there. I'm intrigued by the idea of the aggression and stuff like that. I didn't realise that might be an aspect to it. And then CTE, which I understand is, and hope I get the pronunciation properly, of chronic traumatic
encephalopathy. Yeah,
encephalopathy.
That's a fancy term for the end result of all of this and of all of these bangs on the head. Because every time you get a bang on the head or you get knocked out, the reason that you get knocked out is you lose consciousness. And the reason you lose consciousness is that your brain cell functions have been interrupted. So you cannot function normally. When you think about a sport like boxing, we call it a sport if you like, basically in boxing, the purpose of boxing is to dysfunction somebody's brain.
Yes.
When you think about it. And if you look at boxing, there was a fantastic interview with Muhammad Ali, Joe Frazier, and George Foreman. And it's, you can see it actually on YouTube. And it's very interesting to listen to the three of them, three gigantic men sitting together discussing things. And every one of them was slow. Every one of them had slurred speech. And Muhammad Ali had clear Parkinsonism.
As well, and it was so sad to see that magnificent specimen of humanity end up the way he did in the end. And that's boxing. And yes, and I was particularly disappointed when, and I don't know why the reasoning was, that the boxing world decided at amateur level to stop the, or to remove the need to wear the head protectors that they were wearing.
Well, Sam, the problem with the head protectors, if I can say this, is that actually the brain cells are in a box already, and it's called the skull, okay? So there's very, very little force dissipation with these head, you know, with this headgear. It doesn't really make that much difference.
Does it not? Does,
no, what it actually does, Clem, is it stops you getting cuts in the face.
So
it protects the superficial stuff, but it doesn't really do very much for the deeper stuff.
Am I inferring then from what you're saying is that it's any kind of impact which rocks the brain inside the skull, that's where the damage has been done?
Precisely. Spot on.
Well, okay. Then in that case, Professor Tormey, we talk about rugby, where players are now of gigantic proportions. God, they're muscle mountains in regards to...
I know, they are.
I've often wondered, you know, if players like Tadhg Byrne, who's from out the road in Eadstown and who performed heroically against the All Blacks recently, he always wears a scrum cap. And I said to myself, that's very wise, and maybe many other, every player in the rugby field. But, of course, these kind of impacts, you have enunciated about boxing there. I mentioned and rugby, but also that would apply to any sport, would it not, where impact levels, whether it be Gaelic football, hurling, where you can be struck despite the helmet and everything else.
It certainly can, yeah.
So yeah, should we all stop playing?
Right, this is the point. There's a certain risk element which is definite and present in all contact sports, or sports that are semi-contact. There's a risk element. The question is, at what point is a risk element for you personally acceptable? And now with knowledge of all of these head injuries and the consequences of them, it's up to the bodies, the organisation bodies, the IRFU, the FAI, the GAA, etc., to actually decide how they're going to do pre-monitoring of this.
Well, let me ask you a couple of questions now, because, of course, we should have mentioned soccer. And on this on this program, at least twice in the last 2 or 3 years, I've had a lady called Dawn Assel from the UK on the program.
Yeah, Jeff Assel's daughter.
Correct. Jeff Assel played for England and West Bromwich Albion.
West Bromwich Albion,
You know your soccer, Bill Tormey. Fair play on that. And his daughter
is... Well, as a Rovers supporter, I sort of should. I'm not into Manchester United and Liverpool and all this.
Well, here, I'll tell you a little secret. You're talking to another Shamrock Rovers supporter of decades, back to the McLeish and Frank O'Neill days.
Yeah.
Now, so that we don't digress, Dawn Assel, absolutely adamant that her husband, that her father, Jeff Assel, who suffered from dementia, if that's the correct term, or had the condition of dementia, we should maybe put it more precisely, that it was due to heading a heavy ball. We saw what happened to Jack Charlton. There are many other cases.
Bobby Charlton.
And so, should we ban heading in soccer? What does rugby need to do? Or indeed sports in general?
That's a very hard question, Clem.
Yeah.
The only thing I do, because I can't really answer it, I can have a go, but I haven't, you know, I'm not really a sage. I haven't got. The one thing I want to say to you is that there is evidence in the recent past that there's a genetic susceptibility to as a predisposing factor to CTE. For example, apolipoprotein E is. Their alleles have been show an increased risk of poor functional outcome. In other words, you can predict a group of people who are going to be worse if they get banged on the head than those who haven't got this genetic abnormality. So they're possibly, as research comes up, there's more and more and more things that will show up as to what to do. And one of the things about the HIA business is that Barry O'Driscoll, that Brian O'Driscoll's uncle, resigned from World Rugby, if you remember.
He did, because he felt that World Rugby wasn't taking the issue seriously enough. So
yeah,
Bill Tormey,
if HIAs were BS to a large extent, and I'm in the camp. I agree with them, to be quite honest.
Just let's clear that for listeners who mightn't understand. HIAs are the head injury assessment.
Yeah, head injury assessment. Sorry, Clem, I should have said head injury.
That's where a rugby player is taken off the field, and you're saying they're BS, which everybody will understand. Why are you saying that, Bill Tormey?
Because I really am worried about the evidence for saying that it's all right to put people back on again. That's the point. I think that there's an underappreciation of the deleterious effects of repeated brain injury. And I think that you and I know, and we can't say on air, individuals who played for Ireland who are not well at the moment with dementia.
Right. And as you mentioned, again, I want to refer to another...
And I tell you this, some of the Rovers players in the of the era you're talking about have actually got dementia for the same reason.
Right, so not to digress too much, but on the opening game of Ireland's tour to New Zealand against the Maori All Blacks, a player from Athy here in County Kildare, Jeremy Lukeman, had a very serious collision in the opening minutes. According to everybody in the stadium, the player didn't basically know where he was. He was so hit. Yet, he went off, had this head injury assessment, and was allowed to return to the field before being removed altogether at half-time. Now, that was one incident. Let's not say too much on that particular one.
Yeah,
but you're of a view that head injury assessments in general as carried out in rugby are rubbish.
No, I'm not saying they're rubbish. What I'm saying, Clem, is I think they're inadequate. I think that they have to be taken more seriously than they're taken at the moment. And the sort of things that happened to Jeremy Lukeman seem to happen to a lot of people if you actually follow the game closely. And I don't think that's acceptable at all. I have to say one thing in favour of Mike Ruddock, the former coach of Lansdowne and the Grand Slam coach of Wales. Anytime I sat on the sideline for him, there was only one rule we had. And that is that the physios looked after all the aches, pumps and, you know, the knee injuries and all this kind of stuff. They're super. But all I said to Mike is, if anybody gets head injury, off they come. I don't care about this head injury stuff.
And Bill, I wonder, you see, when...
And they say that's called putting the player first, Clem.
Yeah, and we know, for example, of cases across all sports where the player comes off, is obviously groggy, the doctor might give an assessment, or the person on the ground, and coaches come into play saying, get him back on, and this, that and the other. But we could go around on this for ages. So is the answer then, Bill Tormey, that soccer players stop heading the ball, rugby players have to be kept at a particular weight or muscle size? I'm being a bit trivial now, just to make a point.
I understand what you're saying.
That hurlers must not be able, or footballers must not be able to bash into each other, whether they be male or female, whatever else. Because
the CAA rule of the shoulder really worries me. I mean, there was a few... What seemed to me to be a red card in rugby was a play-on job in GAA a few weeks ago on one of the big matches. I don't want to be more specific.
I know the I know the tackle you're talking about, where a player was absolutely demolished.
He was smashed. Yeah,
yeah.
And it was a legal shoulder. I just thought, God.
Now, in fairness to the GAA, they have done a lot of work and they have issued a lot of guidelines. But I suppose the big worry, Bill Tormey, and we have to make the point out there to anybody who might be concerned, is that, as Bill said, you know, it's possibly to do with if you're genetically predisposed as well, possibly to it. Not everybody will happen. But I suppose the overarching call that must be is that all sporting organisations, whether at national and right down to local sports clubs, need to be very, very aware of this on two levels. One, from the health perspective, and two, the legal eagles could be coming down the road.
Well, yeah, that's the point. And I would see that the large number, I think it's about 185 plus with Ryland lawyers in England who are taking a kind of a group case. If they were not told, or there was no recognition of this decades ago, maybe, you know, and you're talking about Steve Thompson, you've mentioned him earlier on. if you actually look at this, the level of responsibility varies with what you're told before you go out. In other words, if you step into a boxing ring, you're taking a risk of brain damage.
Yeah.
And you're doing that voluntarily. But if you enter into a sport where there's no knowledge of this, no preordained knowledge or anything else, and people should know this, given that the boxing stuff is known since God knows when, 1920-something, it's got different legal connotations.
Yeah, but where does personal ultimate, Bill Tormey, and ultimately, we might finish on this point, does personal responsibility ultimately come into play? I'm aware, like you've just made this point, when I go on a hurling field, as I did, or a football field, or a rugby pitch, as I did harmlessly, I might add, I'm aware of the risks, and therefore I have a personal responsibility. If I take it to a ridiculous level, if I walk across the road after being told, you know, it could be dangerous to cross the road, and I get knocked down, I can't blame you. You know, you shouldn't have let me walk.
That is the point I'm making, is that the voluntarism and the consequence of that is now becoming very obvious in New Zealand, for example, where the numbers playing kids rugby and teenage rugby are actually falling quite precipitously, and it's worrying the All Blacks.
If you were of an age where you had young children, now would you let them
don't
play?
Don't be asking me that question, Clem. That's not. I don't want to answer that question.
All right, okay.
I want to pass one comment finally.
Right.
In the English Football Association have actually decided on a trial to ban heading by football players under the age of 12 from 22-23 season. So they've begun the long road of trying to stop heading. And when you think about it, do you remember old-style football where they didn't play it out from the back, the goalkeeper wellied the ball up in the air, and the centre-half of the opposition jumped up and headed it back? Do you remember that?
Not alone do I remember it, but any of us who have ever played soccer have experienced where we didn't get the ball right on the forehead. We ended up with it coming off the top of our head, and you were seeing stars and dizzy for a while. And that's the kind of thing we're talking about.
Exactly.
So,
precisely.
On that note, Professor Bill Tormey, we want to raise consciousness about this amongst people without being alarmist. Yeah. But it is a tsunami coming down the road, and it's of a concern for everybody, irrespective of what organisation. Sporting organisation you're involved or what level. Professor Bill Tormey, it's wonderful speaking to you. Consultant at Beaumont Hospital and specialist in chemical pathology. Thank you so much, Bill, for taking out of your busy schedule this morning. Now, Ciara, you have Associate Professor of Law at Maynooth University, Dr. Brian Flanagan. I'm certainly looking forward to hearing this chat because I want to know why Irish judges are using Wikipedia.
Yeah, I think we all want to know this. We spoke about it yesterday morning, Clem, on the newspaper review. And Brian is on the line. Hello to you first, Brian. How are you?
Hello, how you doing? Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for joining me. The biggest question, I guess, about this topic is the fact that Wikipedia can be edited by absolutely anybody. And judges in this country, it is being reported, are using it as a source for their rulings.
Yeah, that's right. So we did an experiment on Irish judges. So this work was led by Neil Thompson of MIT, and my fellow workers, my colleagues, were Dr. Adana Richardson and Dr. Brian McKenzie of Maynooth and Ji-Yun Lau of Cornell University. And what we did was we got a bunch of cases, 154 cases, and we randomly put half of them up on Wikipedia, you know, each with its own Wikipedia article, summarizing it, contextualizing it. And then the other half, you know, otherwise similar cases, we didn't put up on Wikipedia. And we waited to see what would happen to the group that were on it compared to the group that didn't go up. And what we noticed was that the ones that were on Wikipedia were used much more often by high court judges in their judgments. So that cite these cases more frequently. They were 20% more likely to be cited than the ones that hadn't been put up on Wikipedia.
This is really confusing because, you know, when you go back to, you know, being a student at third level yourself, you can absolutely never, ever, ever cite Wikipedia in an assignment, in anything. And especially in a law module, like, there'd be no way you'd be allowed to do that. So the question is, why would the judges be using it as a source. That doesn't make sense logically for people who have studied law and legal studies.
No, I mean, it's true. This came up on Twitter yesterday that, you know, we teach our students not to do this and then we find our superior court judges doing it. It's a bit of a surprising one. I mean, you know, there are explanations there. And I suppose the most obvious one is that it's the easiest thing in the world to just Google something. And the first hit you get on Google is the Wikipedia entry for that topic. So if you're, you know, you're human, you're subject to temptation. And if you're in the High Court, you're probably pretty overworked, maybe. So this effect doesn't arise at the Court of Appeal or the Supreme Court. It's only in the High Court judges. And the recently retired president of the High Court, Murray Irvine, pointed out when she was retiring that actually, you know, that the High Court maybe needs another 17 or 18 judges. And so it's possible that what's happening is that they're just so pressed for time that they don't have time to look at expert sources or the actual cases themselves, and they just rely on Google to get by.
And I think the general public do appreciate that, because we know there's a backlog prior to COVID-19, but COVID-19 has definitely not helped the situation. But precedence is something that is so important in terms of, you know, rulings. How is Wikipedia affecting that at all? Because you are noting it's High Court cases.
Yeah, well, so first of all, it's in terms of what cases are actually used by the High Court to say that their decision is right, you know, and they say, well, there's a precedent for that. So it affects which ones they use, but it also affects the language they justify their judgment in. So, well, you know, it's kind of like if you imagine you're just after reading something on a topic and then you're asked for your general view on that topic, you know, chances are, if it's fresh in your mind, your ideas will be informed by what you've just read. And it would be possible to pick that up by comparing the words you use to express your general view with the words that were in the thing you read. And so that's what we're finding. We're finding that the language of the Wikipedia article is echoed in the language of the judgment itself, which is a problem, because they don't know who's writing these Wikipedia articles. And it could be anyone. They don't have to have any legal training. And potentially, they could have an interest in the case that the judge is deciding. It is a fairly chilling prospect, yeah.
Absolutely. And I think it would worry any resident of this country. So researchers, they did conclude that having a Wikipedia article about a Supreme Court precedent tipped the scales in favour of that case being cited. And as Dr. Brian Flanagan noted, absolutely anybody can edit a Wikipedia article. So Irish judges, they are using Wikipedia as a source. Is this because, you know, massive backlog, not enough judges in the High Court in particular? This is for their rulings, prompting fears the Internet Encyclopedia could be manipulated to influence decisions. Thank you for your time this morning. That is Associate Professor of Law at Maynooth University, Dr. Brian Flanagan.
Now, the charities regulator has just issued its annual report for 2021. More than one in three charities are not filing annual reports on time. Hard work of charities is commended in the face of the COVID-19 related challenges. But there are concerns, as the charities regulator is urging all charities across Ireland to comply with their legal requirements. Thought they should be doing that anyway. CEO of the charities regulator is Helen Martin, who joins me on the line now. Good morning to you, Helen. Thank you for joining us on Kildare Today.
Good morning, Glenn.
Now, charities regulator urging charities to comply. What are, I suppose, the legal requirements? You showed that only 64% of registered charities had filed their annual reports on time. Why is that such a concern?
Yeah, so the annual report that you're reading from there obviously provides an overview of the sector and outlines what we were doing last year. And that information that you're referring to there is based on information that charities would have filed with us last year on a thing known as an annual report. And they would have filed it with us last year, and it relates to 2020. So the annual report is some information around the finances of charities, their activities. It'll tell you, you know, their income and their expenditure, and some very high level financial information there. And the benefit of that for the public is that if you go onto the Register of Charities, where you can check any charity is registered. And if you go on there, you can actually see information from this annual report, and it's very easy to follow.
And I'm on your report at the minute, yes. And as I said, 69% of charities declared they comply fully with the Charities Governance Code, but that's 31% who are not. 568 concerns raised, a number of statutory investigations, in that 86% believe charities and the work they do are important, while 36% have a high level of trust and confidence in charities. But on those two particular statistics, I wonder if in recent years, and because of some very high profile cases, are we finding that Irish people are becoming more cynical, some might say, more selective in terms of whether they'll support charities or not?
Well, what we saw in that report, we did a survey last year, Clemmer, we published the results of it, and what we found was that people and members of the public had higher levels of confidence in the charities that they knew, so the charities that were maybe local to them or that they regularly contributed to. But certainly, we definitely saw from the public a greater desire for transparency and accountability. And that's one of the reasons why we're concerned about the fact that the charities who are filing their annual reports, and the number who are doing that on time, they're supposed to do it within 10 months of year end. And that's a legal requirement. It's actually an offence not to do it within 10 months. But we're really concerned to see that that's fallen, because this is a crucial way for the public to get to know what charities are doing.
But it's also reassurance for the public that the money we're contributing is going to where it's intended to go, and that it's not being frittered away on anything or whatever. We have had a number of scandals in recent years, but that it's not been maybe overly spent on administration or management costs as well. And Helen, I'm very struck by the fact that according to your report, we have 11,426 registered charities.
Yeah, well, we actually have 11,000, over 11,500 now. Oh. That would have been at the end of last year. So we've actually gone beyond the 11,500. Huge diversity, as you can imagine, Clem, in relation to the kinds of organisations that are regulating.
And let me tell people, we have 5,982 education charities, 2,150 community welfare. I won't give the numbers for everyone, but we have poverty or economic hardship charities, community development, health, religion, arts, culture, heritage or science, civic responsibility or voluntary work, environment charities, property charities, religion charities, animal suffering charities, conflict resolution or reconciliation. Can anyone set up a charity, Helen?
Anybody can, provided that you're not disqualified. There would be certain things that would disqualify people from being trustees in a charity, and trustees are the people who sit on the board of a charity. People that have really, really important responsibilities. We have an online application form that people can fill out. Yeah. The only thing that we do say to people, though, is really, really think about whether or not you need to set up a charity and whether you're going to be able to do so effectively, because this is not an area to simply get into thinking, that you really just want to do something good. There's lots of ways that you can do that, by volunteering with other charities that are already registered and that are already set up and understand the regulatory framework. So the first thing we always say to people is go onto our website. There's great information there. What is a charity? How to register a charity? And those questions, there'll be some questions for people to consider. What I would say, though, is that you had mentioned there, Clem, and I'd just like to pick up on it, if you don't mind, the idea that, people would be concerned about the cost of administration in charities and money not going towards the good cause, so to speak. But the fact of the matter is, we do expect, some of the charities, you've mentioned different types of charities there, and some of them are providing absolutely crucial services to the public, particularly within areas like health and social care. And we expect that they will be professionally run and that they will be meeting all the standards, whether it's safeguarding, whether it's HICWA standards, whether it's charities regulation, data protection. In order to do that, charities do need to employ people. And they are competing with the private sector to get people in. So one of the things that we will always look at when people are looking to register is if they are proposing to employ people, they have to make sure that they're not proposing to employ people that aren't required. So there is a requirement that it be reasonably unnecessary. But I would just say to the public that in order to do what they need to do and to provide those really crucial services and the thing that the public want to donate to, charities do have to have people there to administer.
All right.
And to do administration.
Okay, point well made. 282 new charities registered, including 98 schools. I wasn't aware the schools can register as charities, but obviously they can. Kildare, for example, looking at the map outlining the number of charities, we have 367 charities in Kildare. Our neighbours in Laois have 139, Carlow 147, Wicklow 329, 3,140 charities in Meath in Dublin, 288 in Meath, 176 in Offaly, and 200 in Westmeath. So that's a significant number of them. I was looking at something there in regards to, there was an increase of 22% in the number of concerns raised, up from 466, Helen, in 2020 to 568 in 2021. How do you interpret that, greater awareness or what?
I think there's greater awareness, but I also think as well that, you know, during 2021, what you would have seen is a lot of charities adapting to the new environment that they found themselves in, so they would be more active. So there would have been charities who maybe struggled initially during 2020, Clem, and they maybe weren't as active or maybe put a pause on their activities, who then found that they were able to continue operating and adapted to the new environment that they found themselves in. The one thing that I would say to, again, to your listeners, Clem, is that, yes, we had 568 concerns, but people would also refer to them as complaints about organisations, and actually that's the crucial thing, about organisations. Not all of those relate to registered charities, because obviously we're contacted regularly about things like your clothing collections, they are not, in a lot of cases, and I would really urge people to really check those labels before they give things out to these organisations. In a lot of cases, they will not be legitimate organisations in the sense that they're not registered charities. Some could be commercial, I should say. Some should be commercial organisations, but they will ordinarily make that very clear. They won't be looking to hold themselves out of charities. But I suppose the point is that those 568 concerns have to be seen in the context of over 11,500 charities. And also, if you look at the number of statutory actions that we took in 2021, these would be kind of formal decisions and approaches that we would have adopted under our Act. We had 33, you know, and that's really to demonstrate, particularly to people who are out there working in charities, not to be fearful if you're contacted by the charity's regulator about a concern, okay? We really just want to hear the charity side of things, but also to assure ourselves and also the public that if there was an issue, it's been addressed, or maybe there wasn't an issue at all and it might be a misunderstanding on the part of someone raising a concern. We look into every concern that we receive, Clem.
Okay.
So anybody who has any concerns in relation to a charity or an organisation that they think is a charity but is not registered, definitely let us know, because these are breaches under the Charities Act. And the only thing I would say is that there are certain concerns that we don't deal with, things that fall within the remit of other parties. We don't deal with employment disputes, and you probably understand the reason for that. That's really for the charities themselves to resolve. And we can't look at issues that maybe would fall within the remit of others, like safeguarding issues. What we are interested in, though, is the governance in the charity. So even though we may not be able to look at maybe a safeguarding issue, we will absolutely be interested in looking at the context that these concerns arise in. So how is the charity being governed? How is it being run? Is it being run well in compliance with the governance code that you mentioned there, Clem?
All right. And if anybody would like to contact the charity regulator, the annual report has just been published. You can get it on their website, which is charitiesregulator.ie, or you can contact them at a Dublin number 01-633-1500. That's Dublin 01-633-1500, or you can find their annual report or indeed engage with the charity regulator on their website, charitiesregulator.ie. And reflecting on that annual report, calling for more compliance from some among the charity sector, is the CEO of the charities regulator, our CEO of charities regulator, Helen Martin. Thank you for your time this morning, Helen. Good talking to you.
Thanks, Clem.
And indeed, as Irish people become more, I suppose, aware of who they should contribute to or not contribute to or whatever else, it's very, very good to know that there is that oversight there. Thanks, Helen, for that. Meanwhile, let's move on now to the Kildare Newbridge Municipal District, but also at County Council level. We're joined by Fianna Fáil Councillor Suzanne Doyle. Good morning to you, Suzanne.
Morning, Clem. How are you?
First of all, co-gorgeous and congratulations. You're the new Cathaoirleach of Kildare Newbridge Municipal District.
That's it, yeah. Thank you very much.
Will you rule with a stern hand? What would be, you hope, your mission for your term?
Well, like maybe an iron fist in a velvet glove. Whatever is required, and we'll all work together. I think collegiality is the order of the day if you want to be successful at that job.
It surely is. Now, Suzanne, to the council meeting. You asked that the council suspend work on the current county development plan as provided for within the Planning and Development Bill 2021, given the restrictions of public engagement due to COVID constraints and COVID-related delay. Is that the only reason that you want them to suspend it, or have you other concerns?
Well, really, I have other concerns, but the only provision to suspend it is under those arrangements. There was no other way it could be suspended.
So what are your concerns?
Well, my concern was, now that we've seen the draft census statistics, our numbers and our core strategy, which is basically your ingredients for the plan, are way out of line. And, you know, if we are not providing for the real world, well, then it's really just a fairy tale or it's an academic exercise. And beforehand, we did plans. And that could happen. You know, the plan at the end, when you'd reflect on it 5 years later, may not turn out as it did because there's degrees of flexibility. But now under National Planning Framework, there is no flexibility. There is a cut-off. So basically, whatever growth projections are there, you cannot exceed them.
Actually, Suzanne, you and I have been doing the same thing because I've also been looking at the preliminary census figures from the CSO with a view to getting a profile of our listenership.
So what do you think, Clem?
Demographic. Well, I'll throw this figure at you, which I mentioned earlier this morning. 24,474 people have moved into Kildare since the last census. There was 25,000 in the 2016 census and a similar number in 2011. And Kildare, along with Meath now, is amongst the most rapidly growing areas in the country. And the figure that I would say to you, Suzanne, which I think is what you're reflecting on, the picture is changing so rapidly. Is there any plan made today is likely to go out of date pretty quickly?
Quickly, yeah. That is my concern. And I think we have a wonderful opportunity because of COVID to realign, because traditionally the census fell in the wrong sequence. So if we press the pause button now, even nationally, I'd be suggesting we should look at the census data and take it from there. You gave the big figure. So we've basically grown by 4,000 people per annum since 2016, since the last census. The projected growth within this plan, what they're allowing for, is approximately 2,700 people per annum. Now, I've never known a county shrink because man meets woman or man meets man or whatever the situation would be. But babies come along. And I also think with Brexit, we're going to see a much higher number in migration to this country.
And also, Kildare is officially part of the Greater Dublin Commuter Belt. We are in the Commuter Belt. And
the country.
People can't get houses in Dublin and they're moving out because I would say that of that 24,000, as in the previous census terms, the vast majority of them are people moving out of Dublin. And
there, you've hit the nail on the head though, Clem, and I think that's the rationale for why this plan is so constraining. That has to stop. Dublin has to start delivering to the people who live in Dublin. And we have to, even from a climate action point of view, the best thing we could do for people's quality of life and climate action and money is to have good working and living ratios to reduce commuting.
Well, what the council said to you in the reply is that the suspension of work in the current county development plan raises many serious and significant concerns for the organisation and the businesses and citizens of the county as a whole and has implications for the council's broader plan, work programme. It goes on to say, for example, that any delay in adopting a county development plan would unjustifiably suspend all work regarding the preparation of local area plans, Kildare Town, Maynooth, Newbridge local area plans, which are currently being reviewed, would be further delayed for an indiscriminate length of time, Kilcullen, Clane, Monastreven, Kilcock, Leixlip, Selbridge and Salins local area plans would also be delayed further.
Well, Clem, and they're right, they would be delayed. But should you get it right or should you get it fast? Which do you want? And we can see the census puts up a huge warning flag. And I think we have, bear in mind, what's the biggest challenge we're facing today? Is a housing crisis. What caused the housing crisis? A lack of supply of housing. So they've based the numbers within our plan on the build delivery over the last 4 to 5 years. Well, the build delivery has clearly been insufficient. So why would you base future growth on a delivery that didn't meet the need? And so, look, I share the concerns. But my big concern is in 2 years' time, we'll be into a new council. We'll be doing a new plan. We'll be told to review it. So all that work that's been invested will have to be reinvested. So I don't see the efficiency in that. And at the same time, we saw that report today about bad building standards, etc. I would prefer to see a bigger cohort of our staff invested in watchdogging and oversight of the building programmes that's going on in the at the moment, rather than engaging in a fantasy that will have to be reviewed.
All right, on that note, Suzanne, and the report Suzanne is referring to is where the builders, it seems, won't have to step up and meet the cost of remedial works, which could amount to billions of euro in terms of the problems that have been well chronicled and reported in recent times as well. But meanwhile, reflecting on her call to delay the preparation of the county development plan, or indeed to make adjustments, and on the basis that the census is revealing 24,500 more people have moved in over the last couple of years, and that moving into Kildare continues. We're nearly becoming, if you like, the Crimea of Dublin at this stage. Dublin will be soon claiming to extend their borders, I'd say, in regards to... And Suzanne makes an interesting point that the county development plan is only allowing for growth of around 2,500 when there's, much more than that moving in. Anyway, we'll hear a lot more about that. Councillor Suzanne Doyle, newly appointed Caoimhe of Kildare Newbridge Municipal District, she brought that motion 19 to the county council meeting of the last couple of days. Thank you, Suzanne, and good morning.